It is December 8th, 2005. It has been 25 years since most Americans heard about a tragedy in New York City when they were watching the New England Patriots and the Miami Dolphins on Monday Night Football. And Howard Cosell said this.
ABC News has confirmed that John Lennon, a member of the famed Beatles, maybe the best-known member, was shot twice in the back outside of his apartment building in the west side of New York tonight, rushed to the Roosevelt Hospital, dead on arrival.
That is how most Americans found out that Beatle John Lennon had been shot by Mark David Chapman a quarter century ago. Today we devote most of the Paul Harris Show to that moment because the Beatles were such a huge part of my life. My earliest memory of seeing anything on television was the Kennedy assassination in November of 1963. That has always been one of those where were you when moments. My second television memory was February 9th, 1964, when the Beatles appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show. It was in that horrible December night in 1980 that we turn our attention today, and the two decades that preceded it. We have the man who was the emergency room physician at Roosevelt Hospital that night. He will tell you his story in just a little while. We have Larry Kane, the former TV and radio reporter who was the only American reporter to actually tour with the boys in 1964 and 1965 as they went around America and got to know John Lennon fairly well, and has a new book out about him called Lennon Revealed. I've also dug into my own archives, and I couldn't believe I found this. In 1988, I interviewed John Lennon's sister, Julia Baird, and I will play parts of that for you, audio I know that you have never heard, and we have all sorts of other stuff from the archives as well. But first, Al Wyman joins me in the studio. You may remember him from his work for so many years in this building downstairs, working for Channel 4, and then later working at Channel 5. Now he is the vice president in charge of, what's your official title there, Al?
Vice president for public understanding of science.
He works at the St. Louis Science Center in this new phase of his career. But his connection to the Beatles goes back to the Hollywood Bowl in 1964. Before I play this audio, tell me what you were doing in 1964 and how you ended up in the Hollywood Bowl that day.
Well, I had covered their news conference when they arrived in Los Angeles prior to the concert. I worked at KFWB, Channel 98, they called it. And KRLA, our rival station, Bob Eubanks, was the sponsor of this concert.
He actually put up the money to bring them to Los Angeles,
yes,
and put them in the Hollywood Bowl.
And had a special news conference after the airport news conference at the Cinnamon Cinder, a nightclub that he owned. And he froze out, of course, all the competition, like us.
Yeah.
So I, armed with a ticket to the concert and my LAPD press pass, just acted like I knew what I was doing and walked all the way through security and walked to the edge of the stage and parked myself there with my KFWB tape recorder and microphone.
Now, you were not live on the air.
No. I taped it, but as soon as a concert was over, I went to the mobile unit and started feeding the tape in, and everybody at the station said, "Oh my God, how did you get in there? How did you do that?"
Did you and your colleagues at KFWB actually scoop Bob Eubanks and KRLA with the audio on the air?
Well, I think we may have done that because it was over. It was not going on at the time, and they said, "Bring the whole tape back. We'll play everything."
Mm-hmm.
So I took the tape back to the station after I fed in a report, and the rest is history.
Now, this is not the tape as it aired. This is your actual raw tape.
The raw tape. And the station did play it when I got it back. But this is the basis for an album that John Babcock, Roger Christian, and I wrote the Friday night following this concert and decided we were going to put out a documentary album. And we wrote this. And Gary Usher, who produced all of the Beach Boys albums, was our producer. And we did that at the Round Building Capitol Records right up there, the street from Hollywood and Vine. And we went in on a Friday night. We came out sunrise on a Sunday morning. And that Double Truck album is what we came up with.
Yeah, which I also have here in the studio. It says a narrative and musical biography of Beatlemania on two long play records. And I got to tell you, Al, today was the first time I've touched a vinyl record in a long, long time and queued it up in the studio. But what we're going to hear here is not off the album. This is the actual raw tape. How old were you at the time?
I was a baby, let's put it that way.
Were you in your 20s at the time?
Early
20s.
Yeah.
Al Wyman, radio reporter for Channel 98 KFWB, which was, I believe, the Westinghouse radio station.
No, it's now Westinghouse. It was owned by Crowell Collier when I worked there.
Okay.
The encyclopedia people.
In Los Angeles at the Hollywood Bowl in 1964, here he is on the side of the stage as the Beatles start their concert.
I don't know if this sound has to be explained. This is the sound of Beatlemania in the Hollywood Bowl. This is Al Wyman, and I'm standing on the stage of the Hollywood Bowl with a din of shouts going in the background. The Beatles are now on stage and beginning their performance. Listen to the crowd. As the Beatles start their performance, the roar increases. I'm looking into the audience. Flash bulbs are going off in every direction. The audience jumping up and down in several areas. This is something like I've never seen before. Listen. If anyone in the audience is able to hear what's happening for the shouting, the flash bulbs, it almost looks like gunfire. The flash bulbs, that is. I don't know if you're able to distinguish any of the sounds other than the shouting, but the Beatles are performing on stage at this very moment in the Hollywood Bowl.
You know what's amazing about that, Al, is that they're actually singing Twist and Shout there,
yeah,
but you can't hear a word.
You couldn't hear it.
And I bet you they couldn't hear themselves, and certainly nobody in the crowd could hear anything.
No, it was that way the entire concert. It was screaming and yelling, and it was just phenomenal.
And they just performed for about 20, 30 minutes, something like that?
Something about like that,
And the screams were nonstop.
Oh, no, nonstop. I mean, it went on and on, and jumping up and down, and flash bulbs, and young girls crying. There was a later in that narrative, there was the president of the Beatles Club, and she practically collapsed on the stage behind me.
Wow.
She was in tears. It was phenomenal.
Were you a Beatles fan?
I was just a reporter, you know, and I knew it was phenomenal. I had gone to the news conference, and the news conference had degenerated into total bedlam, so I just climbed over everybody. I have a videotape of this at home. I'll show you sometime.
Okay.
And I just went up next to Paul and started talking to Paul because it was useless to try to shout questions because it was such bedlam.
So while the rest of the press conference is, they're attempting to have the rest of the press conference.
I just went up there and talked to Paul now. I figured, okay, I'll talk to him.
Now, one of the parts of the John Lennon lore is that he was pretty good with the snarky comebacks. He was a witty guy. Was he that way when you were there?
Yeah, he was the guy that was kind of giving the banter back.
Mm-hmm.
John was the guy that was real, the sharpness. The others were just kind of like there. Paul was just kind of sitting there wondering, what in the heck is this all about?
Did they seem overwhelmed by the circumstances?
I think they were. When they came off the airplane, it was bedlam. This was in the Pan Am terminal, and it was totally filled with teenagers. And you'd never seen such bedlam. And they didn't let them down to the news conference. They let some of the teenagers down, like the president of the Beatles fan club.
Mm-hmm.
But it was bedlam. I'd never seen anything like this before.
Did you ever have any other exposure to them on that stop in Los Angeles?
Just at Hollywood Bowl, but then we set up a promotion, and we went down to San Diego, and our DJs were on the stage with them in San Diego, mm-hmm, as one of the presenters. We worked that out.
Did you get to meet them at all?
No, except for that news conference and to talk to Paul and to make this album, which made them a lot of money. It didn't make us a lot of money.
I was going to ask you about that because it's called The Beatles Story. It's a double album that you did over a weekend. And how long after you did it actually get pressed up and released as a record?
Oh, it was released within the next week after we did it because it was pretty hot and people wanted, they wanted anything that had the Beatles.
Yeah, well, I can understand that being a person who has all sorts of Beatle-related stuff, including all of their albums on vinyl and pretty much every other format that they've ever been released in. But what do you mean they made a lot of money? You insinuate that you didn't.
We did not. We thought when we came up with the idea that we're going to be wealthy the rest of our lives, we'll never have to work again. Well, what you don't count on is the fact that EMI got, I think, 95%. That was their firm. Mm-hmm. They got 95% of everything, and Capitol Records got the rest. And we were paid $500 a piece to do that, Paul.
That was it?
That's it.
No royalties, not
no
a piece
royalties,
of the action later
not
on?
Not a piece of the action.
Is it available on CD now? Do you know?
You know, I don't know. But that's why I'm still working, Paul. Otherwise, why would I?
You know, you were not the only one to get the shaft from the record company. I've heard from interviews with Lennon that he and Paul and George and Ringo didn't get tremendous royalties, that they actually made much more money later on after starting Apple Records.
I think they probably did.
But those early days, those first few albums of theirs, up to maybe Sgt. Pepper or maybe even later, they were not getting a lot of it. And, you know, the record company was taking way more than 95%. So, you may have only made $500, but you're part of Beatle lore. Now, since we're looking back on the 25th anniversary of the murder of John Lennon, give me your memories of that night, December 8th, 1980,
or
how
stunned.
You heard about it.
I was working downstairs at Channel 4, and when this happened, I thought, oh, my God. I mean, we've got a huge chunk of history that's passing before us here. So I went home and got my the video that I had, and I got the audio and put together a story that we had on our late news that night about, you know, this was such a stunning thing, but how they affected people and how they changed the music industry, because they really did. They were a phenomenon. No one had ever seen anything like this before.
Now, the people who are saying, why are you doing an anniversary special about the death of some rock star? There are people who look at it that way.
I can understand that. But these people changed music history the same way the iPods are changing the way people listen to music today. That was the trend.
They were the leaders of the British invasion.
The long hair, all the groups with long hair came after them. The only person that had long hair before the Beatles was Sonny Bono.
That's true.
With his big big furry vest that he wore.
Yes.
In the days when he came up with that Caesar and Cleo thing. He was a record promoter.
Right, before they were Sonny and Cher, yeah. And, of course, the musical impact they had in the years following that and the innovations that they put together in the studio were remarkable. And also because after leaving the Beatles, he became kind of an unusual icon, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And he represented something that was out there. He was one of those out there people. And a lot of people, I think, thought, hey, if he's out there, it's okay for me to be out there.
When you were reporting it that night, because I'll tell my own story about the night he was murdered and the morning after, but did you feel a personal loss? Like, did you have a moment where you said, oh, my goodness, this is part of my life?
Yeah, it was, because I think I don't remember exactly how I started it, but I said, going back to Hollywood Bowl and being there that night and seeing them for the first time, that you realized that you were witnessing history, and this was musical history. And to have the passing of one member of that group was really, it's like, wait a minute. That's part of my life that's disappearing off the face of the earth.
Yeah, they were such an important force for those of us of our generation. And to have been there yourself and to have even had a fleeting moment with them in the history of the Beatles, something I'm certainly a little bit jealous of.
Well,
but thanks for coming in and sharing the story.
I'm,
I appreciate
very
it.
Very happy to share it with you, Paul.
Al Wyman, who is now over at the St. Louis Science Center, promoting science instead of...
And the Titanic.
And the Titanic, which is the new...
The new exhibit,
there.
And it is phenomenal. You'll have to come over.
I will. I'm looking forward to bringing my daughter and my wife over and taking a look at it. Thanks for coming in today. Al Wyman here on the Paul Harris Show. When we come back, we'll talk to Dr. Stephen Lin. You don't know the name, but he was the emergency room physician at Roosevelt Hospital who held John Lennon's heart in his hand that night. He's next on the Paul Harris Show, Remembering John Lennon on KMOX.